Alright, this is Pure Decking for September the 27th, 2012. So, I forgot to look up this day in history. So, that said, tonight we've got Sard and Suave, and I'm drinking a little bit of Red Stag and working on building a pirate box. What are you guys up to?
Drinking Shock Top and customizing my pirate box.
I'm definitely not playing the Kerbal Space Program right now.
Did you say the Kerbal Space Program?
Yeah, right.
We send twins into space. See what happens. God. Oh, I'm sorry. I apologize. We were talking about World War II before we started the show, and then he said the Kerbal Space Program. Hell, we actually got a lot of our space program from German scientists, though, so I guess it's not that funny.
All of it. The entire thing.
Yeah.
It has a rocket in it. It came from Nazis.
You know, a little bit of the space program, the part that got us into space, you know, no biggie. And, let's see. This is the show about the stuff that interests me, and I've... laughing so hard now at the intro. We got feedback. We got some awesome feedback from Weird Wolf. I'm not going to read the whole thing because it was long-winded. I had made kind of I'd almost say a snarky post on the front page because people were asking me to update the news post on the front page, and I got some feedback from him essentially assuring me that yes, people do look at that. So I might want to pay a little bit more attention in the future what I post there. But he did tell us he found our stuff more entertaining and informative than both the old media and other podcasts that are out there. So, dude, awesome feedback. Thanks for that.
Absolutely.
Sarge, you see that too?
I did. Yeah. Thanks awesome. Again. We love feedback.
We do love feedback.
Interesting to hear from people.
So, anyways, couple of, other quick station notes here. We've been working on that. Both Sard and myself have been working on it. We should have the shows back in rotation fairly soon, I think.
I'm going to be working on that this weekend. Right now, last weekend I got the kind of the normal rotation working. So with the Galaxy 15 station IDs that play every once in a while. Same thing with the show promos and the clips. Well, that is working. And
yeah, you got
awesome.
The clips and the show promos put back in there because I had left it with the station IDs working and like the Patient Zero Power Hour playing every night. So
yeah.
Did you take that out of there? Or...
Not
that
yet. That's what I'm going to work on this weekend. Is
I was
getting
say,
all the,
that was...
yeah, all the archive shows returning to the normal rotation like they are on the schedule.
Yeah. Well, the thing was with the Patient Zero Power Hour is I was just testing the scheduler really and it just kind of stuck, so that's not sticking around, although we might do that, feature some of our artists and give them different times, but not just Patient Zero. We've got a couple of other groups on the station that we might do that with.
Yeah,
so
that would definitely be cool.
So anyways, just kind of digging around, Suave and I were talking about this a little bit earlier, but we kind of were going back and forth. We got onto this because of the cell phone issues. I guess the easiest way to start it off, Suave sent me this link to a story on Pocketables where a guy had built his own voice assistant using Tasker and hooking it into Google Voice. So it was like Siri, except he was programming it himself on his phone. Now, there were some projects back when Siri first came out to run your own little proxy and add a bunch of extra functionality to Siri that way. This is actually doing it all on the phone, just taking the feedback from Google Voice. And the trick of it was that you could hook Tasker into Google Voice and then have Tasker run scripts, trigger things, do whatever, based on the voice commands you were giving it. So this guy essentially sat down and programmed the Star Trek computer into his phone using Tasker and Google Voice.
Oh, and he actually got in, like, really personalized it. So he got, like, personalized responses based on his queries and stuff like that. So like, and you know, like a lot of it was like highly specific to just him. So he didn't actually release any of his task or code or anything like that to anybody else, because it wouldn't really make sense for everybody.
True, but the article goes into how he was doing it, so yes. You could sit down and replicate his work for yourself.
Oh, absolutely. And like that's the really cool part, is just like, you know, ever since I started reading sci-fi back when I was like a kid, I've wanted a system like this, you know, like voice controlled computer system or whatever, you know, that I could use to like automate stuff and stuff like that. And even like most of the older sci-fi books and stuff like that, I'm thinking of something by Heinlein, actually. I can't remember the name of the book, but anyways, this guy has this car. And it's got this computer system in it that he uses to like command the car. Right. And like the guy actually says at one point in the story that like, oh yeah, it sounds like it's actually super intelligent, but it isn't. I just programmed in all of these responses, so it gives the appearance of being intelligent. And I've always thought like, well, that's probably going to be how those systems are set up. And now we can actually set that up ourselves. And It seems to be, you know, like it'll take a little bit of work, because you have to set up a response for like pretty much every action, but it's totally doable. And you know, when you set up with some decent voices aside from like the standard TTS voice, which sucks, go pick yourself up by Vona or something like that. Yeah, you can get yourself a pretty sweet little setup for automation with your phone.
Right, and you know, that got me thinking about it. And you were mentioning it with the sci-fi interfaces. I've been watching a little bit of Star Trek lately, and you notice something. The captains always have this little laptop on their desk, and it's obviously a prop, and it's just something for them to blue screen stuff on later.
But, piece of plywood.
Yeah, it's a piece of plywood that's been painted. But the concept is that their computers are so advanced, they've only got a couple of little touch surfaces and voice control. Like, the voice control is that good that they don't have a keyboard on these things anymore. And, you know, I got thinking about it, our cell phones aren't really that different. They have a keyboard, but it's all in the touch screen. It's not a physical keyboard.
Yeah.
And if you think about it, it wasn't that long ago that you wouldn't have trusted a system to work on something like that, because it's like, well, what if it crashes? What do I do?
Yeah.
I mean, it still has a couple of physical buttons, but not anything like, well, like I'm thinking of my old cell phones. I used to have a couple of old Windows mobile phones that, you know, full keyboard on the face of the phone there. So.
Mm-hmm.
Which actually,
that's a good point.
I kind of miss typing on those things, because I got really fast at it. But
you know, I still prefer a physical keyboard over a virtual one or on-screen keyboard.
Well, how long until you get, you know, teenagers who are like, "Oh God, your keyboard has buttons on it"?
Probably already there.
Yeah, it's true. It's like, watch. I can't use the laptop, man. The screen's not touchscreen. I gotta have a tablet, man. I mean, you know, how long do you have people who? Like, I don't know about you guys, but I cannot touch type on a touch screen. I can get fairly close.
No, I can't either, dude. Like,
but I've got to watch my fingers while I'm doing it.
Oh, yeah.
Really,
and you know,
yeah.
I don't think anybody can, because you really need that physical feedback to kind of know where your fingers are. Because otherwise, you
oh,
know,
dude,
like that,
dude, no. I remember I work at a college. I've sat there and watched people text each other back and forth on touch screens, on like iPhones, without looking at the fucking phone.
Well, I bet you they can't match the speed that you'd get with the actual keyboard, though.
They're pretty quick.
What happened? I seem to recall, I think it was a story on Slashdot about a new touchscreen technology that actually raises, like, when they bring up a keyboard or whatever.
Yeah, it can, like, inflate little areas of it to make
bubbles. Yeah, like, actually bubbled up the plastic layer or whatever that's below it to make it feel more tactile like that.
Yeah, you know, I was reading about that, and that's actually a good idea. But, you know, and you wouldn't even need that for all the keys. You'd really just need, like, you know, like the two little raise bumps you have on the F and the J keys. You know, just something like that, so you can keep your fingers on home row if you're actually typing on a tablet.
If you look on the tablets, a lot of them draw the little bump on the screen anyways. I mean, there's no physical bump there, but I make fun of the iPad for this, is the big keyboard has the little bumps on the home row keys, and it's just why?
Well, you know, this is probably a situation where this is something that's been around for long enough that people don't even know why it was there, and they're just including it because, well, it was on the original keyboard, so we're just going to include it. We don't know why it was there, but it's just,
Oh no, anybody who knows how to touch type knows what those two little bumps are for. It's to tell you where you put your hands.
Only if you've actually been taught how to type. If you've just kind of taught yourself, you don't know. You know, it's only if you've been like taught in a school or actually trained how to type. If you're self-taught, you'd have no idea what that was for.
Okay. Well, Suave, you had this awesome idea for using your cell phone.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Oh, okay. So, like, I'm huge on the whole home automation thing. And you know, I've always been kind of limited by, you know, like, there's all these different systems. Like, there's, I can't even remember the names of any of them anymore. But, you know, I did a bunch of research, and there's basically
X10,
a bunch of...
Zigbee.
Yeah, X10, stuff like that. There's all these different systems, but they're not really compatible with each other. And, you know, it seems like a lot of them are quite proprietary and quite expensive. And it's not really a good setup for home automation because a lot of it involves it having to wire stuff or, you know, just like having to go get like all kinds of different stuff. And it's just a pain. But, you know, like I'm starting to see more and more now. There's a lot of opportunities for doing a lot of this sort of home automation with your cell phone and various like home appliances. And like, for example, like you can go out and buy like a light bulb that's Bluetooth enabled now. And this light bulb is an LED bulb that's probably going to last longer than you will. And it's, you know, it handles all the colors of the rainbow. And you basically just like have a little app on your phone. You like turn it on and off or change the color or whatever just from your phone. So like it's cheap and easy to add this sort of stuff to electronics now. You know, I think this light bulb is like $30, which is a little expensive, but really it's not that bad when you think about it, especially how long it's going to last you. And, you know, especially when you think about like LED bulbs are generally like $15 anyways. So, you know, add an extra $15 for automation. That's pretty awesome. And then when you combine that with an app like Tasker, you have quite a few different options. And you know, like there's a lot of other stuff you can get out there now. Like on Kickstarter, there's a product now that's Wi-Fi and Bluetooth enabled. And once again, you can control with your phone. And it's for home automation. It allows you to control various appliances in your home. And actually, I've seen a number of different products that are coming out there. So, you know, like back, you know, even like 5 years ago, when you think about home automation, you'd think about like a big computer, you know, buried at the center of a house that everything's kind of linked up to. And, you know, that's, you go in, you like log in, you set up your schedules and stuff like that. And that's how it works, how the home automation works. But, you know, I'm starting to think that's not how a home automation is going to work anymore. It's all going to be linked directly to your mobile device. And, you know, like, it's not going to be even location specific. Like, you go into work and, you know, your phone detects, okay, well, he's sitting at his computer. I'm going to log him in now. Or, which is totally doable now, actually. There's also, like, you know, very location-aware abilities with your device. Or, you know, like, yeah, you come home, turns on your lights, you know, you lay down in bed and put it on your bedstand and it turns on the alarm for you and turns out all the lights in the house and like make sure your oven's off or something stupid like that. So really it's all going to be on your phone, and people never really realize that your phone or your mobile device was going to be powerful enough to do all of this. So not only can it do the automation, you can actually get like the voice feedback and input from it now too, which really is quite good. I know like a lot of people don't like the voice input because it's not very accurate or anything like that. But, you know, personally, when I'm at home, I use voice input all the time for doing any sort of typing on my phone. And as long as you speak in a very clear and concise manner, it generally doesn't have any problems detecting what you're trying to tell it. Now I generally don't do this in public because you kind of look weird when you're talking to your phone, which is really unfortunate because like I think it's pretty awesome and it should just be socially acceptable to do that sort of thing, but we're not quite there yet.
You don't want to look like the crazy guy.
Well, no, you gotta get one of those Bluetooth more headsets. Like the crazy guy.
You get one of those Bluetooth headsets and you just point at it whenever somebody gives you a crazy look.
That's actually a really good idea. Except the problem with Bluetooth headsets is their batteries don't last long enough. You know, like...
I had a pair that would last me most of the day.
Yeah, but were you using it all? Like, was it actually on and listening to you all the day? Because, you know,
I wouldn't
like
say
with,
all day, but I was using it quite a bit for to listen to music.
Like with voice input, generally it's gonna have to be on all the time and listening. Because, you know, if you have to like go turn on your Bluetooth headset every time you want to do a voice input, it kind of defeats the purpose.
Well, that's why I intend to add extra ports to my Pirate Box. So if I need to flash charge my phone off my Pirate Box, it's not a problem.
Fair enough.
But I don't know. I mean, it's interesting you bring up some of the home automation stuff. I still kind of envision there being a central station just so your phone has a central point of access, but still right. being the point of access. I've actually got. I turned all the home automation features off actually because it sort of blew up my air conditioner, but my alarm system for my house actually has a Z-Wave system in it that I could, you know, spend a bunch of money and get the controllers for my lights installed. And what it is you put it in place of your light switch. It gives you two little touch buttons, and you wire it in place of your light switch, and then either you can tap the button, turn your lights on and off, or you can use the panel to turn your lights on and off, or you can pull down the iPhone app. And at the time, the Android app wasn't done. It's probably done by now. I didn't care that much because at the time I didn't have an Android phone, but you could use your phone and automate that stuff. And I see no reason you couldn't hook that kind of stuff into something like Tasker and the voice system to, you know, do the whole reduce lights by 20%, whatever, and just tell it that shit. Mm-hmm. It takes some programming, cool. But the thing is, that would all went actually through my alarm panel. So I'd have a central point of access, and it's not a powerful computer, but it is a computer. So I could see it being where you maybe have a computer running somewhere in the house, and we might be talking like a thin client, you know, like a little Raspberry Pi or whatever, just kind of a central point to talk to.
Right.
And then, you know, the phone sees your Wi-Fi, so it knows which one it's talking to. And you go to work, and it sees your work Wi-Fi, so it switches into work mode. And, you know, again, you've got your Bluetooth headset, so you can just tell people you're talking to your great aunt Gertrude or whatever when you're really ordering it around.
Oh, that's beautiful, too, because you could even just say, like, you know, set up your device so it only responds when you say Aunt Gertrude.
Well, like I said, I've been watching Star Trek, so I've got mine set to respond to computer, which just for that extra, you know, funny thing. Of course, I've hacked it. I was sort of hooking it into Metasploit and trying to get it to do the whole computer take over that machine thing.
Nice.
Hadn't gotten that far with it yet, but, you know, hey. We're getting there.
There you go. That's a neat idea and all that. I just don't see. I mean, $30 for a light bulb, dude. That's freaking expensive. Like,
well, coming from a guy how many that's light replaced, bulbs in a room.
Yeah, I mean, you realize how many light bulbs there are in a room? That is a freaking lot, especially in the whole house.
Well, yeah, but you know, like this is Gen 1 tech that I'm talking about here. Like this isn't like, and you know, like really when. You're talking about like standard incandescent or even the I don't know those new fluorescent light bulbs and stuff like that. Even those fluorescent light bulbs can be as much as $10. But when you're talking LED light bulbs that have lifespans in like the hundreds of thousands of hours, $30 is a little bit much. But you know, it's probably going to replace like 20 to 30 regular light bulbs over its lifespan. So yeah,
maybe.
it's a little bit of investment to begin with, but it's probably going to be about the same in the long run. But on top of that, you have the added functionality of it having wireless control over your system.
Well, I would say,
and you know, like I'm not going to say like you should replace every single light in your house, but you know, maybe have like you know your entrance light and the one in your bedroom or something like that, where like it might actually be useful to have a system like that.
I would say though definitely the outdoor lights so you can you know put them on a timer and you know whether or not you're home and stuff like
dude,
that.
Dude, have it sense when you walk up to your front door so it turns on the light.
Yeah, exactly. But the one thing that I think is a little overplayed is the whole you can change the color of the light bulb. Yeah, it's kind of neat to put a you know RGB in there and you know have it run it real bright. Honestly, I can think of very few situations
pretty
where
much
I need
Halloween
to be able to...
on drugs or in the bedroom.
You nailed it right there. I wouldn't have put them in that order though.
We gotta save the best for last.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. You just did them in reverse. That's fine then. Yeah, I just, I don't know, the whole color changing thing. I mean, the full range of color, it's kind of a neat gimmick, but I can't see a hell of a lot of use for that.
My sister actually
would be nice.
my sister had one of those light bulbs. It was it had a little infrared, believe it or not, controller for it.
Yeah.
And yeah, it was kind of neat, but really it was just, yeah, that's exactly it. It was a gimmick. She played with it a couple of times and then never changed the color on it ever again. Also, because infrared is really difficult to use with a fucking light bulb. I don't know what genius came up with the idea to have an infrared remote control for a light bulb. Not a good idea.
Oh, no, I'll tell you what happened with that right there. The original guy who designed it used an RF module, like a little FM module. And then you had some guy in manufacturing go, what? No, those things are expensive. We got to get the price down. We'll go infrared. Those are cheap. And, you know, because it's the same thing they do in those helicopters, right? Those little remote control toys. Is, you know, they're RF when they design them, and then they switch them over to infrared to make them cheaper, and somebody just wasn't thinking. But, you know, I mean, that's kind of why I like the idea of hooking it into the light switch, not the bulb itself. Mm-hmm. That way you can swap the bulb out, and if you have a room where you need to be able to, you know, put the lights into disco mode and, you know, lower the mirrors and you know, start the music, then by all means. But, you know, for most rooms, you're going to want on, off. So I like the idea of hooking the light circuit so you can put whatever kind of bulb is appropriate.
Mm-hmm.
So, plus, too, you might have older light fixtures that won't take that kind of a bulb. I know my parents have several fixtures in their houses, in their house. Multiple fixtures, singular house. Sorry. I'm just... I've been drinking.
I was going to say, also, what about the other aspect of home automation? I mean, you know, people always control, you know, their stove or like the window blinds and stuff like that. All that requires a little servo or some sort of command and control unit. I mean, that shit adds up right now too. That's why, I mean, as it is, it's cool, but I don't think it's very practical for most people right now.
Yeah, that's also true.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, like really, these sort of things, like it's not super practical. It's for the lazy and the gadget hungry, you know. But really, like when you think about it, like your smartphone isn't really a practical device either. Like, really, what does it really do that you couldn't do with, you know, a laptop or just wait till you get onto a computer or something like that? You know,
there are cases where I
but you're in the tech field. You're in the tech field and this is important, but I can guarantee you like 95% of the people who have smartphones could easily get away with a dumb phone.
But how the hell else am I going to play Angry Birds when I'm on the shitter?
So I was having a conversation with my girlfriend the other day, and you know, I said, oh well, hey, I found this cool app for Android, you might want to check it out. She's like, oh, I don't really install apps on my phone. I'm like, why do you have a smartphone? She's like, well, I don't know, everybody else had one. And then I face plant.
Yeah.
And just remember, you're dating this woman. But,
what about the security aspect of that? I mean, now
that's
you have
why
all
I
this...
want this. That's why I want this to go popular, so I can hack somebody's house and make their blinds go nuts. And
I mean,
flash
there,
Morse
I know
code
there...
through the lights and try to give them seizures.
Yeah, there's protocols out there, but the only reason why they haven't been broken or hacked into is because it's not as mainstream as it, you know, it has to become more mainstream or whatever before it'll get any attention.
Oh yeah,
actually,
it
kind of
makes
Z-Wave.
Me leery, you know, like
all
these wireless devices that like control the locks to my house and stuff like that.
The best way to deal with that is to use only near field communication.
But
then,
even then, dude, I can see freaking someone, you know,
no,
instead of the kids running up to your house and putting the paper bag full of dog shit on the front and lighting it on fire and running away, they're going to be crouching underneath your window with a freaking smartphone hacking into your lights bulbs.
Well, no, because like with you know, NFC, like you could set it up so it only accepts the signal if it's from like 2 feet away or something like that, and you would just have like your little sensor sitting at your desk or your, you know, your nightstand or wherever you need it to be used. It depends on how you're actually implementing it, but you could make it secure
Well, just, no, you can't make the pro, you cannot make the signal carrier itself secure. They still haven't got Wi-Fi secure. What you have to do is you have to make the applications accept commands only from a certain set of devices, however you want to do the identification. You can do that, but you're not going to be able to secure the channel.
It'd be the same as like MAC address filtering for
okay, Suave, I will let you set up a network with MAC address filtering, and I will break into it for you just to demonstrate to you why you're wrong.
No, I'm sure that you could, but it's still like way more secure than anything else out there. Like, yeah, no matter what you do, people can always get around it. Just like people could even just like wait till you go to work and then let themselves into your house. You know, you just kind of like...
That kind of stuff keeps honest people honest. The whole idea with MAC address filtering is it keeps people who aren't trying to break into your network from using it. But just for anybody who's wondering, the way you hack into a network that's got MAC address filtering on, you pull out, you know, AirCap or NetStumbler or Kismet, and you record the MAC addresses of the devices that are on the network, and wait for one of those to disappear, then you set your device to use that MAC address. It's very simple to do.
You don't even have to wait for them to disappear. Give yourself the same MAC address. It's kind of a pain in the ass.
Yeah, because then your connections are going everywhere, but it will work if you just set it. Yeah. I wait for it to disappear because it's less likely to be noticed. If you don't wait, whoever's MAC address you cloned is going to have connection problems, and you're going to have connection problems. So somebody might realize something's up. So it's just how quiet do you want to be. The other thing you can do is you can actually kick them off and then
send DL packets.
So, but that's kind of being a bitch. But yeah, no, it's totally easy to snag MAC addresses out of the air and clone them. So I've just had to point out that one because Swab brought that one up I can't let that one go.
But like, you know, it's obvious nothing is completely secure, but there are definitely steps that you can take that are going to make you more secure than your neighbors, and that's really all you need.
Unless you've pissed off the right people.
In which case, nothing can help you.
Unless you make it really annoying for them, in that case, they might go a different route, but... Yeah, you're kind of right about that. So, pirate boxes. Mine, I'm still waiting on this flash drive to clean off. It's got about a minute left as it formats. And
are you using USB 1.0?
What? No, this thing was full.
Fair enough.
I had a 32 gig flash drive full, and I'm copying everything off, and I'm just now starting to format. So I'm giving it a full format because it's also in TFS. I don't actually have to do the full format, but, you know, I figure... give the router less to worry about.
Sure. Yeah, pirate boxes are fun. We were just talking about them a little bit before the show. Bob and I both have our setup, and we were talking about... Last night I spent a couple hours kind of working on the user interface, just trying to update it. Because it comes with a functional user interface, and that's kind of where we'll leave it. It'd be nice to yeah. Nice to update it a little bit, make it a little more pretty. Just kind of customize it so when people do connect to it, what'd you say, Suave? So it doesn't look like here's this box
waiting to hack your system. Yeah.
Yeah.
Because really, that's what it looks like.
But I take an evil access point and run the burp suite against anyone who connects to it all the time. Very successful, by the way. Works great. You know, you go sit someplace, and especially when they name their Wi-Fi something different, because like the bookstore is contracting it through somebody else, so it shows up as like Verizon_, you know, insert bookstore name here _, you know, whatever. So you just name it to bookstore_ here Wi-Fi, and yeah, people connect to it. You can even now. Normally, forward packets onto the regular internet for them anyway, so I can run SSL strip and you know, I should stop talking because
should have a show dedicated just to wireless. Start talking
show?
About all the different
series.
Series,
yeah,
all the fun stuff that you can do with it.
But
a big complaint that I have, we were talking going back to pirate boxes, is well, it's just a complaint from my end because like the whole interface and all that is written in Python, and I'm not familiar with Python, so that kind of sucks. So I'm having to learn.
Python's not that bad.
I'm just used to PHP or Perl or something like that. I would understand a little bit better, and I guess Python is like space era. White space sensitive?
Yes, it is.
That sucks.
Oh, not but... used to that, are you?
No.
Who came up with that idea?
Somebody I know,
who
right?
Really, really didn't like curly braces and semicolons.
I guess so.
No, seriously, that's what it is. In Python, you do not have to use curly braces. You do not have to use semicolons because it takes into account the white space and the carriage returns.
It's just madness.
So, let's see.
What are the customizations?
Pirate Box failed out on my install here. It doesn't like my kernel.
Ooh.
That's not good. Do you have OpenWRT installed on it already?
Huh? Yeah.
Okay. So you're trying to install the...
Yeah, I was trying to
package.
Run the script, and it, said cannot install package Pirate Box, cannot satisfy dependencies, and it's all kernel dependent.
You know, I actually ran into that problem too. Ended up going and finding a tutorial, and there are some packages that might not be listed that you need to install first. I couldn't tell you what they are now anymore, though. I can't remember.
What kind of router did you get again, Warps?
WRN 703N or whatever it is. TP-Link 703N.
Yeah, he didn't get the little tiny one. He got the bigger one.
It's pretty small.
Well, yeah, but yours has a external antenna or something, doesn't it?
No.
Oh. Is it just like a little box?
Yeah. Huh. Yeah, it's just a little box. It's a... Here, let me pick it up. It's a TP-Link TLWR703N. I wonder why it's
okay. That's...
Well, I'm not going to sit here and try to correct this on the show. I was going to set up my Pirate Box on the show, but it doesn't look like that's going to happen.
Okay. Yeah, it actually looks like identical to the 3020 or 2030 or something.
Yeah, that's the one the instructions are for, is the 2030.
Yeah, that's what I've got.
Same here. I was going to say I follow the there is some on their wiki the. Pirate Box wiki, there's a tutorial for the 3020 that worked great for me.
That's actually the one I think I'm following, is the one for the 3020, because it's the same, it's practically the same chipset.
Oh yeah, I'm sure.
Huh. Well, I'll fight with it later and talk about it on the next show. I'm just a little surprised I was getting kernel errors. It might not really be kernel errors, it might just be that's how it's identifying whatever the package is. So, Well, maybe I pulled down the wrong version of Pirate Box or something. Who knows?
What kind of case did you guys put yours in? Or did you?
Not yet. I'm going to print something that I haven't gotten around to.
I've got a little hard pack external hard drive case that I don't use for anything. It's going to end up in there. The little nylon thing.
Okay.
I'll probably eventually... move it into a tin of some sort so I can add a power switch and a external antenna. But I need to get it working first, so.
That'd probably be good. Yeah, I need to, I'm going to run the LEDs from the battery for status and the router LEDs out and just kind of put it on the outside of the case. I put mine in an outdoor cases. It says it's a type 05 case. I think you guys know what a Pelican case is. It's kind of, it's very similar to that.
Okay. Nice and suspicious. Why is this man walking around with a Pelican case?
This is not something around with those.
And why does this Pelican case have an external antenna?
This is not the external antenna you're looking for.
I guess it's better than... a lunchbox with an antenna sticking out of it.
With a big giant skull on it? Yeah.
Yeah. I see what it is. People are saying don't use the actual OpenWRT image for the router. Use the one for your all's router.
Mm.
Apparently it works just the same.
Yeah, so it must be the same chipset, I imagine, then.
Yeah.
Yeah. Cool. So I'll have to install OpenWRT on it and start again. Because apparently they haven't revved the kernel for mine, but they did for yours. But it's the same chipset, so. Okay, whatever. I'll fix that here. I'll fix that after the show, because I figure you guys, we're already, what? We're half an hour into the show, and I've got news to read. So, we'll deal with that here after a bit. So, moving right along here into current events. First story is from Torrent Freak. This one's really fun. Wearing t-shirts with the slogan, "Piracy is illegal." The movie industry-sponsored anti-piracy group ACPOR, delivered several boxes full of IP addresses of alleged illegal file shares to the Attorney General's office last year. The evidence was handed over in two batches, and the group demanded the authorities act against 2,000 alleged pirates. Sure they did. Here's your $100, and here's your $100, and here's your... You know, if you want to rip up a group, that's how you do it, right? Let's see here. We are doing anything we can to alert the government to this very serious situation in the entertainment industry, Akapor commented at the time, adding that 1,000 complaints a month should be enough to embarrass the judiciary system. Think that, wouldn't you? However, last year it turns out Akapor's actions have backfired, and the anti-piracy group is now facing the embarrassment. The Department of Investigation and Penal Action looked into the complaints, and the prosecutor came back with his order this week. Contrary to what the anti-piracy group had hoped for, the 2,000 IP addresses will not be taken to court. Worse, Akapor, the prosecutor, or worse for Akapor, the prosecutor goes even further by ruling that file sharing for personal use is not against the law. From a legal point of view, what country was this? This was Portugal. From a legal point of view, while taking into account that users are both uploaders and downloaders in these file sharing networks, we see this conduct as lawful, even when it's considered that the users continue to share once the download is finished. The prosecutor adds that the right to education, culture, and freedom of expression on the internet should not be restricted in cases where the copyright infringements are clearly non-commercial. In other words, somebody's finally starting to get it. Nobody's making any money here. In addition, the order notes that an IP address is not a person. The ruling explains that a person connected to the IP address is not necessarily the user at the moment the infringement takes place, or that the user makes available copyrighted work, but rather the individual who has the service registered his name, independent of whether this person is using it or not. This means that the account holders connected to these 2,000 IPs are not necessarily all copyright infringers, similar to orders we've seen in the United States previously. Finally, the prosecutor ruled that even if the file sharing for personal use would be seen as illegal, the artists themselves should explicitly declare that they are not authorizing copying for personal use. In other words, in Portugal, they've declared that file sharing for personal use, no profit involved, is not illegal, and they're not going to pursue it. Moreover, they have stated that IP address does not equal person, and that because it's not explicitly in the artist's statement of rights that you can't share this, that it's not illegal.
Where's your hallelujah button?
Looks like I'm moving to Portugal. Isn't Portugal also the country that decriminalized like all drugs and had a massive reduction in crime rate and prison population?
Something like that.
Sounds like they're taking a like no nonsense. Hey, let's look at the facts approach to lawmaking.
Well, I like the fact that you know somebody up there actually understands what's going on. It's like, look, no, that's absolutely correct. An IP address is not necessarily a person. I've probably got like six to my name right now. So
yeah, I mean, they aren't getting bullied by the freaking.
I like how they had hired some quote-unquote anti-piracy group to protest in Portugal. It's like, what? It's like, I like how they haven't tried that here. That's just funny.
Yeah.
But Yeah, anyway, so somebody in Portugal is paying attention and actually understands how these things work.
About goddamn so, time.
Yeah. You're right. Where is that hallelujah button? No, that's not it. Anyway,
close enough.
Close enough. Okay,
that's
next one up.
Hallelujah to some.
This one's from SourceForge. On September 25th, SourceForge became aware of a corrupted copy of PHPMyAdmin being served on the CD Network's KR1 mirror in Korea. This mirror was immediately removed from rotation. The mirror provider had confirmed the attack vector had been identified and is limited to their mirror. So in other words, somebody popped one of the SourceForge mirrors and modified a copy of PHPMyAdmin-3522 all languages.zip. And only anyone who pulled it down from that mirror is affected. We believe that only one file was modified in the mirror, and we are conducting additional validation to confirm, and we'll provide update once this process concludes. And so that mirror is still out of rotation at SourceForge. They added a PHP backdoor. Specifically, you're looking for a file, server_sync.php. So if you've installed PHPMyAdmin recently or updated it recently, they know for a fact that there's approximately 400 users that have downloaded the corrupted file. You need to, you probably your best bet would be to uninstall PHPMyAdmin and go get a fresh copy. Because they know that there was a backdoor installed in the one coming out of a Korean mirror. So I'm wondering how many other projects are affected.
Yeah, really? It's kind of funny that it came out of Korea, of all the places.
Well, I mean, that's probably just where the mirror happened to be. But this is a, you know, I think we've talked about this before in Pure Decking. What do you do when somebody's hacking the software distributors?
Yeah, there's like, as a user, there's not much you can do until the distributor decides to notify you about it.
Yeah.
Like, how do you know?
Well, in this case, you go look for server_sync.php in your PHPMyAdmin install. But in the future, the only other thing to do is profile the behavior of your system and watch and see. It's like, it's making a connection to a server in Russia. Why is it doing that?
But, you know, like, the thing is, like, with news like this, unless you're actually following tech news, you're not even going to know about it.
Oh, no, I sent this up to our webmasters, and they were like, yeah, we haven't updated PHPMyAdmin in years. And it's just like, wait, what?
That's
like,
almost worse.
That's worse. Yeah,
that's so much better. Jesus. Don't worry about it.
Yeah, it's like, oh, no, that's not a problem for us. Oh, my God.
One more thing to scan for.
Yeah.
A new. Just think of it as a learning experience. You get to learn a new Metasploit module.
I like that. That's you. Toasty. There you go. You deserve that. That was awesome.
But honestly, I bet you out of those 400 downloads, 390 of them aren't even going to find out about this.
Well, with any luck, somebody's going to try to contact them. I mean, if they go through into SourceForge account, but hell, I never sign into SourceForge when I'm downloading stuff, so I don't know.
Yeah, me either. You're probably right, dude. I mean, those will be living out there in the wild somewhere.
Well, not only that, I don't know about you guys, but when I'm setting up lots of servers, I'll pull down one package and throw it on a flash drive, and I'll set up 5 or 6 servers from one flash drive.
Oh, yeah.
That's a good point.
I'll set up the virtual machine and then clone it however many times I need it.
Right.
So just because it was downloaded approximately 400 times, how many times has that file been reposted, copied somewhere, thrown in an archive? Hell, I'm still trying to get rid of corporate antivirus version 9 at work. Like, the thing's 5 years old. Why are you still using that? Well, we had it on a flash drive and we were just going with it. No, fuck! Go get the fresh one on the share that I set up specifically for... Anyways, enough bitching about work. This next one up, this is just fun. This is from Adobe. We recently... English helps. We recently received 2 malicious utilities that appeared to be digitally signed using a valid Adobe signing certificate. The discovery of these utilities was isolated to a single source. As soon as we verified the signatures, we immediately decommissioned the existing Adobe code signing infrastructure and initiated a forensics investigation to determine how these signatures were created. We have identified a compromised build server with access to the Adobe code signing infrastructure. We're proceeding with plans to revoke the certificate and publish updates for existing Adobe software signed with the impacted certificate. This only affects Adobe software signed with the impacted certificate and that runs on the Windows platform and three Adobe Air applications that run on both Windows and Macintosh. The revocation does not impact any other Adobe software for Macintosh or other platforms. To translate, an Adobe server got hacked. One of their build servers got hacked. And whoever hacked them was borrowing their signing code to write their own malware and sign it.
Oh.
Now, I like how they're glossing over that one of their build servers was hacked, so we don't know how many tainted copies of Adobe whatever are running around out there with, you know, botnet code in them.
More than PHP MyAdmin.
But to continue with their post here, this post is right off Adobe, by the way. I've cut it up a little bit, but sophisticated threat actors use these malicious sophisticated threat actors. There's a wow. How many words can you throw in the word hacker? I mean, really?
what the hell does that exactly mean?
Actually, cracker is the more correct term, and I don't mean the racist term. Sophisticated threat actors. It's just like we have to sound, you know, because if we say anonymous broke into our server, actually. Whatever. 12-year-olds in their basements use malicious utilities like these signed samples during highly targeted attacks for privilege escalation and lateral movement within an environment following an initial machine compromise. As a result, we believe the vast majority of users are not at risk. We have shared the samples via the Microsoft Active Protection Program so that security vendors can detect and block these malicious utilities. So your AV, yeah, good luck with that. Customers should not notice anything out of the ordinary during the certificate revocation process. Yeah, when the little skull and crossbows comes up and it says mess with the best, die like the rest, yeah, totally fine. Don't worry about that.
Hey, you get zero cool out of this.
We have identified a compromised build server that requires access to the code signing surface as part of the build process. Although the details of the machine's configuration were not to Adobe corporate standards for a build server, this was not caught during we're not caught during the provisioning process. We are investigating why our code signing access provisioning process in this case failed to identify these differences. This was written by some marketing flack, and my God, have they put big words in there to try to confuse people. The compromised build server did not have rights to any public key infrastructure functions other than the ability to make code signing requests. So they could read our certificate, but they couldn't change it. Our forensic investigation is ongoing. To date, we have identified malware on the build server and the likely mechanism used to first gain access to the build server. We also have forensic evidence linking the build server to the signing of the malicious utilities. We can confirm that the private key required for generating the valid digital certificates was not extracted from the HSM. We believe that threat actors established a foothold on a different Adobe machine and then leveraged the standard activated... The what? And then leveraged standard activated advanced persistent threat tactics. Oh my God. APT? They're blaming it on fucking APT? Advanced persistent threat is a buzzword people throw around when they're too embarrassed to say we got hacked. To gain access to build server and request blah, blah, blah. So Adobe got hacked all the shit. Somebody stole their certificates and now they're trying to spin. Like, oh yeah, no, that server wasn't up to standards. Really? Are you sure about that?
Imagine that. Dude, it's the users again. I bet you it's probably some developer that, you know, they have a bank of normal build, like approved build servers or whatever, and is like, man, these things are freaking slow. They're always getting used. Let me just, you know, plug this other random machine into my office here. Oh, look, the network port was live. New build server, install software.
I've got my old Sun workstation here. That thing always compiled code fast. Let's go with that.
Yeah, see, exactly.
I only make that joke because I spent a good couple hours today working on a Sunblade 150, which is running great on Solaris 9, by the way. yeah, I put Solaris 10 on there. Slow as shit. Anyways, well, what do you expect out of a 600 and some odd megahertz machine, 512 mega RAM? Nice workstation for its age, though. I tell you what. It's like a 10-year-old workstation. I mean, but, yeah, I'm not sure what I'm actually going to do with it. Anyways, this next one up, this next story is just fun. This is actually from the Navy, navy.mil. Refueling U.S. Navy vessels at sea and underwater is a costly endeavor in terms of logistics, time, fiscal constraints, and threats to national security and sailors at sea. In fiscal year 2011, the U.S. Navy Military Sea Lift Command, the primary supplier of fuel and oil to the U.S. Navy fleet, delivered nearly 6 million gallons of fuel to Navy vessels underway, operating 15 fleet replenishment oilers around the globe. Refueling Navy vessels, that is a shit ton of oil. Refueling, it's not surprising they use a lot, it's just wow. Refueling Navy vessels at sea can prove in many ways to be a costly endeavor. The U.S. Navy Research Laboratory is developing the chemistry for producing jet fuel from renewable resources in theater. The process envisioned would catalytically convert H2O and H2 directly into liquid hydrocarbon fuel used as JP5. In other words, they're going to turn seawater into jet fuel. Scientists at the U.S. Navy Research Laboratory are developing a process to extract carbon dioxide and produce hydrogen gas from seawater, subsequently catalytically converting the CO2 and the H2 into jet fuel by a gas-to-liquids process. The potential payoff is the ability to produce JP5 fuel stock at sea, reducing the logistics tail on fuel delivery and with no environmental burden, and increasing the Navy's energy security and independence, says research chemist Dr. Heather Willier. NRL has successfully developed and demonstrated techniques for the recovery of CO2 in the production of H2 from seawater using an electrochemical acidification cell, and the conversion of CO2 and H2 to hydrocarbons, organic compounds consisting of hydrogen and carbon, that can be used to produce jet fuel. So in other words, they've done all the chemistry. They've done it in a lab. The reduction and hydrogenation of CO2 to form hydrocarbons is accomplished using a catalyst that is similar to those used for Fischer TROPSCH, TROPSCH, Fischer-TROPSCH, I'm sorry if I'm saying that wrong, reduction in hydrogenation of carbon monoxide, adds Willier. By modifying the surface composition of iron catalysts and fixed bed reactors, NRL has successfully improved CO2 conversion efficiencies up to 60%. So they're using iron as a catalyst. They're using iron and probably a shit ton of electricity. Located at NRL's blah, 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 blah. Currently, NRL is working on process optimization and scale-up. Once these are completed, initial studies predict that jet fuel from seawater would cost in the range of $3 to $6 per gallon to produce. Yeah, it's a two-step process. They take seawater and create liquid hydrocarbons. And then an iron-based catalyst has been developed that can achieve CO2 conversion levels up to 60%, blah, 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 blah. Yeah, so they chemically, they use iron and electrolysis and get hydrogen and CO2 from seawater and then chemically convert them into jet fuel.
I suddenly have a new reason to move to the sea. That could be kind of fun.
Well, you know, it's not quite as attractive as it initially sounds. Like, for one, it's going to take more energy to get fuel out of the seawater than you're going to get out of that fuel.
True, but they've got
a net loss system. Yeah, they've got nuclear reactors, so it's fine for the military. Anybody else, it's kind of dumb.
Well,
I guess maybe if you had a massive solar farm or something like that, it might be useful. But like, I don't know if anybody here has ever tried electrolysis or like making hydrogen or anything like that. Those electrodes get destroyed by the water very, very quickly. Like, you go through electrodes really quickly. And I'm guessing that's what's going to be happening with that catalyst. So yeah, it's iron. It's relatively common and everything like that. But to make any decent quantity of anything, it's going to get pretty costly.
Well, they're saying $3 to $6 a gallon for jet fuel. That's better than trying to ship it around.
Oh, yeah.
I think you're right that, you know, this process alone is going to be energy loss.
That's $3 to $6 for, you know, the military that's going to have the infrastructure. It's going to have essentially the free power from the nukes and everything like that, which I'm sure they're not taking into account into the cost. So like, yeah, sure. But like, you know, for one of us to set up a system like that, it's probably going to be closer to like $10.
Sure. But, I was thinking in terms of military, again, there's going to be a massive savings in not having to ship jet fuel around.
Oh, absolutely.
Because they can just go out in the field and make it. And plus, too, it lets them use the current planes longer. We don't, as far as I know, we don't have a battery and electric system capable of running a jet plane.
You know, I'm curious as to how big the equipment is required for this and how long it takes to create fuel. Because, like, what if you built a plane that had this system on board? It just land on the ocean, make more fuel, and then continue on.
Just go down and skim up the water. Yeah, I like that. That'd be awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I mean, this is cool, though. They're using seawater and making jet fuel. That's badass. I like that.
Oh, absolutely.
That. You know, it might not be the most energy efficient thing in the world, but, you know, they're operating nukes already at sea. So I think it's a good model, and I think it lets them continue to use, current systems. I mean, you know, it'd be nice if they could get alternative energy up and going. I'm not really a big proponent of that because I don't think the technology's there. I mean, if the technology was there, great. I don't think it is. But, this lets them use the stuff that works longer. So that's cool. And yeah, they're running nukes, so they've got electricity to spare. Let's see, but yeah, this is cool. So I'm hoping to see some form of this. It'd be fun when you get to the civilian market and you can just dump seawater in your car, make it go.
Heck yeah!
Oh, yeah.
The only thing is, that'd be great if you live on a coast. Not so good if you're like in Wyoming, but you know, because then you're shipping seawater instead of gasoline. But at least it's not as likely to burst into flame. Of course, then you might get the Half-Life 2 effect where, the global ocean levels have dropped like 5% or something like that. It's like, what'd you do with all the water? We burned it.
What?
I can just see the alien invaders going, oh, fuck no, we're leaving. This is crazy. Yeah. Enough of that stupid shit. Let's see. Wow, it's going to be a long show tonight. We spent too long talking about cell phones and pirate boxes. Is this my last story? No. Next to last story. This one's from money.cnn.com. There's a good chance that your bank's website was attacked over the last week. Since September 19th, the websites of Bank of America, JP Morgan Chase, Wells Fargo, US Bank, and PNC Bank have suffered day-long slowdowns and have been sporadically unreachable for many customers. I've been on my banking website since then and haven't had a problem. The attackers, who took aim at Bank of America first, I was just making sure of something here. The attackers, who took aim at Bank of America first, went after their targets in sequence. Thursday's victim, PNC's website, was inaccessible from the time this article was published. Security experts say the outages stem from one of the biggest cyber attacks they've ever seen. These denial-of-service attacks, they're talking about DDoSes here, huge amounts of traffic directed at a website to make a crash, were the largest ever recorded by a whole margin, according to two researchers. Banks get hit by cyber attacks all the time and typically have some of the best defenses against them. This time, they were outgunned. The volume of traffic sent against these sites is frankly unprecedented, said Dmitry Alpetrov, co-founder of CrowdStrike, a security firm that has been investigating the attacks. It's 10 to 20 times the volume we normally see. Actually, in a DDoS, I don't know how the hell your... Anyways. It's like, usually your equipment crashes, so I don't know how you're saying that.
I just want to interject here real quick. Notice how they put the caveat in there. Is claimed by a security researcher.
Yeah, that's the journalist saying, "Cover my ass. I'm not in trouble if it's wrong."
But like, really, when you think about it, I like anybody could be considered a security researcher. Do you read a internet security blog? You're researching security, therefore you are a security researcher.
As somebody in the security field, I take offense to that.
Well,
security researcher, asshole. Well,
no, you absolutely are. But like, I'm just saying, this could be applied to any field. You know, like, just look at all the UFO experts that you keep seeing on the History Channel.
Suave is comparing my job to UFO researchers.
Hey, isn't that what you do? Aliens.
Oh, I'm just going to stop the story there. I'm not going to read the rest of it. They're DDoS attacks. They've been rolling through hitting banks. and people are surprised at the size of it, and then they start talking about ATM hacking and all this other stuff. But it's a DDoS attack. There are people trying to knock over websites.
My question is, why would you DDoS a bank's website?
That's what I was thinking.
Trying to piss off their customers.
I guess.
Well, a lot of bank websites, that's, you know, the front end is where you log in to get to the banking system, like, so you can go pay bills or whatever. So if you can't log in, then that hurts the bank's business, in theory. Right. It also, you know, if they're paying for their bandwidth, kind of sucks. But no, the only real reason is to knock it over. DDoS attacks are pretty juvenile, really. I mean, it's look, you have knocked over a billboard. I mean, that's essentially what it is.
Yeah.
Now, for some websites, that's also their storefront. So if you're DDoSing a website that makes their money by selling stuff, that's kind of important. But for banks, if you've really got to do something, you can always get up off your ass and go into the bank.
Very true.
You know, I mean, the banking systems themselves are all mainframes, IBM AS400s and shit like that. So if they're connected to the internet directly, somebody at that bank just needs to be shot. But you're not going to DDoS the bank's behind-the-scenes system, like the networks the ATMs connect to and stuff. Those ATMs, don't get me wrong, those ATMs are on the internet, but all the banking stuff is done via, you know, VPN, things like that. So,
right.
If you're getting at the actual bank's databases, that'd be cool. Actually, I want to know about that. If you're like getting into banking databases through the internet, I'd love to see some of that shit. So
I actually know somebody who works in the industry, and they see crazy shit going on all the time.
Oh, I'm sure. I'd like to see some of the techniques they're using. My favorite are the ones where people open up ATMs to install keyloggers and shit. So, but because that shit happens, like. Oh, yeah. Not just the skimmers, like actually opening the things up, trying to get into the banking systems through the code. Like, yeah, those have cameras in them, buddy. let's see. Last story up. This one's from Ars Technica. 7 rent-to-own companies and a software developer have settled federal charges that they use spyware to monitor the locations, passwords, and other intimate details of more than 4,200,000 customers who leased computers. The software, known as PC Rental Agent, was developed by a Pennsylvania-based Designerware. That doesn't sound like a fly-by-night operation. Designerware. It was licensed by more than 1,617 rent-to-own stores in the U.S., Canada, and Australia, so we need to warn you, to report the physical location of the rented PC. A feature known as Detective Mode also allowed licensees to surreptitiously monitor the activities of computer users. Managers of rent-to-own stores could use the feature to turn on webcams so anyone in front of the machine would secretly be recorded. You remember the thing that high schools got in trouble for, like watching kids in their bedrooms? Same thing.
Exactly. Yeah. Why the hell would they need a detective mode in order to see what you're doing on the computer? I can understand the GPS thing. If it's a rent-to-own type thing, all right, so they quit paying us, we need to go back and repo it, so we need to know where it is.
When it comes down to it, it's going to be the same thing as any of these apps that people have on their tablets or their phones. You know, if it ever gets stolen, you can turn it on and find out who stole it. I'm sure, like, okay, think about the type of person who's going to rent to own anything,
right?
Really.
Right.
Like, the odds of getting a rent-to-own product getting stolen are probably quite a bit higher than just, like, buying a product outright. And I'm sure they've probably dealt with this sort of thing a lot in the past, and have probably gotten somewhat sick of it. They've decided they were going to, try to figure out, a way to prevent this from happening in the future. You know, I'm sure, there's definitely a potential for abuse out there, but odds are they're probably just doing it so they can recover stolen merchandise.
I guess. I mean, when you rent to own it or whatever, I'm sure there's some sort of contract you have to sign, which I'm kind of surprised to see. Did you say they settled a case? Like,
yeah, under the proposed
covering their ass.
Yeah, pretty much. Under the proposed settlement, the defendants agreed to curb data collecting software on rental PCs and to stop using deception to gather any information from consumers. The settlement is subject to public comment for 30 days, after which the FTC will decide whether or not to make it final. Let's see. Yeah, it was the thing was just beyond locating these machines. It was doing full key logging. Oh. It could had the capability to display fake registration pages for Windows, Internet Explorer, Office, Yahoo Messenger. When customers entered their name, address, and other personal information in the form, the data was sent to Dataware servers and then emailed to the rent-owned licensees. So it wasn't just locating the machines and being able to like cripple them if somebody wasn't paying their rent on it. It was full-on monitoring of what these people were doing with their computers.
And yeah, if it was actively monitoring, then that's no good. If it had the ability to monitor but it wasn't monitoring, then that's okay. But if they were actively doing it, then fuck that shit.
Yeah, it's not right, but I mean, I'm sure you signed some sort of contract. Mm-hmm. Accepting
them
monitoring.
Yeah, I think that's where the problem was, is people didn't know it was in the contract and it wasn't being explained to them very well.
Well, who explains every little, fine print in a contract? But yeah.
True. So, anyways, yeah, so that was my last story for this.
Me love you long time.
This one's fun. This is not a security tool. This is not, a technique. This is a game. Rock Paper Shotgun has the story here. You'll want to pull up the show notes and click the link because that's where the patches are. System Shock 2 and Thief 2 are regularly hailed as classics for a reason. They're meticulously designed, tough but not unfair, and they've been around for a gazillion years in game technology time. Okay, I'm going to stop with his reading. Essentially, System Shock 2 is old. It will not run on modern computers very well. It crashes a lot, and it doesn't work all that great. However, on a French forum called R9 Forever, somebody released a set of patches to bring System Shock 2, unofficial patches, up to being able to, it fixes it so you can play it on modern machines. You can play it with high resolution. These are ancient games, so you can just go in and crank the settings all the way up, right? So, in short, go play System Shock 2. Here's the patch to play it on a modern PC. Go play System Shock 2. If you haven't played System Shock 2, it is the cyberpunk first-person shooter. It is the game that is the predecessor to BioShock. If you liked the BioShock games, that's where they got their inspiration with System Shock 2. It is a first-person RPG. It is cyberpunk as hell, and you are essentially fighting an evil AI that thinks it is a god.
Nice.
So, I'm reluctant because I know Sard and Suave haven't played the game, so I'm almost reluctant to talk about it, but that scene where you walk in and Shodan reveals herself is still, to this day, one of the most badass scenes in a first-person shooter. You realize
God,
how old the game
is. God, ruined
it
for me now.
Yeah, I know it. The game's only, 12 years old, so... it's like people calling for it's like people calling spoilers in Lord of the Rings. It's like it's been around a while. Get over it. But go if you haven't played System Shock 2, go play it. Just play it. You'll enjoy it. You also develop a horrible fear of monkeys. So that's really all I've got for today. Be afraid of the monkeys. And, of course, listen to the stream. As I was talking about at the start of the show, we're always working on it. We're always looking for new music to add. If you are a music artist and you're wanting us to play your music, talk to us. Pure Decking every Thursday. Shoot the Noise on Wednesdays. Nameless Review 7 on Mondays. And, of course, always check out the Galaxy 15 Radio site, the Twitter handles, use the feedback form, and the shout box. That's all I've really got. Has anybody else got anything before I hit play on the music here?
Yeah, I wanted to give a shout out to, I think it was Psychros, but it might have been Werewolf. I don't remember, but they emailed us about the Plague Sequence, free album. I'm going to look and make sure it's Creative Commons. I believe it is because they offer their music for free up on their site and all that. But thank you for sending us music. Like Creative Commons free music, and I like adding new music to the site. So look for that coming.
Fear the monkeys.
Customs in the town.